I'm going to talk today about habits. I recently have come across a couple articles, a book, all dealing with habits, research that's been done about the power of habits and how they work in our lives. And I found all of them really personally fascinating. They seem to apply to me pretty well, and might possibly apply to you. So I think the first place where I really am struck by this whole, back up for a minute and just say that habits can be a positive force in our life and they can be a negative force. I think for the most part, the tendency is to think of them as negative because we have so many bad habits. They are just our way of being, of thinking, of indulging ourselves seems to get in the way of our happiness. And of if we're dedicated to practice, it definitely we notice it because it gets in the way of real practice. But at the same token, by the same token, habits can be obviously very positive. It's a habit to get up in the morning and brush your teeth. It's a habit to get on the mat and do zazen at a particular time or at least every day. And so a lot of skillful practice is learning to work with habits. In my life, my first attack on habits that I saw were causing me problems was the obvious one of trying to give them up, just going directly at them and using willpower. And that's a good way, that's one tool in the toolkit, so to speak. When we find there's something that we're doing over and over again that causes problems, maybe let's say smoking cigarettes. If you can go at it by just quitting, why not do that? The problem is we've only got so much quitting power. They've actually studied this experimentally, and if you have people quitting one thing and sort of using up their reservoir of willpower, suddenly they start leaking in other areas. So people who quit smoking cigarettes typically start eating sweets more or indulging in other ways, and it can be pretty maddening when you try to solve all your problems with this the blunt tool of willpower. It's sort of like Mickey Mouse in Fantasia when he starts he casts that spell and gets these brooms to start doing his sweeping up for him, and then they won't stop, and he starts chopping them into pieces, and then they multiply and suddenly he's completely overwhelmed. It's really hard to simply decide through logic or aspiration that I'm going to do a certain thing in a certain way and I'm going to be a certain kind of person and have that work out. But we'll get into that a little more. I wanted to start by reading this interesting article that I read called Warning, Habits May Be Good For You. And it appeared in the New York Times on July 13th, just recently. The writer is a guy named Charles Duhigg. And what he's talking about is this effort that was made to try to get people in third world countries to wash their hands. The person who was working on this was a guy named Dr. Val Curtis, who was director of the Hygiene Center at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And they've been trying for quite some time to instill the habit in people in countries like Ghana of washing their hands before meals after they've been to the laboratory, because it's so easy to transmit diarrhea and other diseases for diarrhea and other tropical diseases. through unclean hands. And studies have shown that actually the transmission rate can be cut by 50% if people would just wash their hands. We actually make the same effort in Sachin. We ask people to wash their hands, especially when it's in the winter, when people are tending to get colds. And I'm not sure if everybody does, but it certainly has been shown to help. According to this article, diseases and disorders caused by dirty hands, like diarrhea, kill a child somewhere in the world about every 15 seconds. And about half of those deaths could be prevented by the regular use of soap, studies indicate. So basically, we'll take just this one country they're talking about, which is Ghana. And in Ghana, they found that about 4% of people washed their hands with soap after using the lavatory. And so they did lots of campaigns talking about disease, and they found that that changed people's habits not at all. And so this this Dr. Curtis decided to go talk to the people who really know how to manipulate habits, people like Procter & Gamble, Colgate-Palmolive, and Unilever. He said they've invested hundreds of millions of dollars finding the subtle cues in consumers' lives that corporations could use to introduce new routines. And then they talk about all the different products that we've now been conditioned to use. It's kind of astounding when you step back and look at how we live now compared to how things were 20 or 30 years ago. Suddenly everybody's carrying bottled water around and drinking it. People are cleaning rooms, and then when they're completely clean, they're spraying them with Febreze, this spray that removes bad odors. There's a lot of examples. People are drinking $4 a cup coffee when they never used to before. And all these things, and other good things, you know, people are brushing their teeth twice a day. That's something that we didn't used to do. All these different habits have cues, sort of triggers that get people to do what the manipulators want them to do. Carol Burning, a consumer psychologist who recently retired from Procter & Gamble, a company that sold $76 billion worth of Tide, Crest, and other products last year, said, "Our products succeed when they become part of daily or weekly patterns. Creating positive habits is a huge part of improving our consumers' lives, and it's essential to making new products commercially viable." And of course, the companies that sell things for profit become very skilled at this. Unfortunately, the nonprofits who are trying to get you to use a condom or not to smoke dope don't have the sophistication. And they've actually studied some of those ad campaigns, examined about 100, there were about 100 studies of anti-drug campaigns, which showed that in many cases, the viewers' level of drug abuse actually increased after seeing the commercials, perhaps in part because the ads reminded them about that bag of weed in the sock drawer. And similarly, ads to promote condom use to prevent AIDS seem to, for some reason, increase the rates of unprotected sex, perhaps because the commercials make people more frisky than cautious. So what they did with this first let me back up again, and just quoting from the article, it says, "These and other studies revealed that as much as 45% of what we do every day is habitual. That is, performed almost without thinking in the same location or at the same time each day, usually because of subtle cues. For example, the urge to check email or grab a cookie is likely a habit with a specific prompt. Researchers found that most cues fall into four broad categories: a specific location or time of day, a certain series of actions, particular moods, or the company of specific people. The email urge, for instance, probably occurs after you've finished reading a document or completed a certain kind of task. The cookie grab probably occurs when you're walking out of the cafeteria or feeling sluggish or blue. Our capacity to develop such habits is an invaluable evolutionary advantage, but when they run amok, things can become tricky. And he talks about studies, one where they give participants a bowl of tomato soup, and what the participants don't know is there's a tube leading into the bowl at the bottom that ensures that the level never goes down. And people who are given such a bowl will eat twice as much as people with a normal bowl of soup. The cue is you're finishing the bowl. You're not thinking about how much tomato soup you really want. It's one of the reasons why there's such an epidemic of obesity in America. It's directly linked to supersizing our meals. Companies have found that food is very cheap, and if they just give you more, they get more customers. Unfortunately, the side effect is there's more of each of the customers after they've been eating these meals for a while. Another study, they looked at exercise habits among students who had transferred from one college to another. When locations remained stable, that is, the new school had an outdoor track just like the old school, for example, the students continued running regularly. But if the tracks were too different, the exercise tapered off on average. In another experiment conducted by researchers studying smokers, those wanting to quit were more than twice as successful if they started kicking the habit while on vacation when surrounded by unfamiliar people and places. Habits are formed when the memory associates specific actions with specific places or moods, said Dr. Wood, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke. If you regularly eat chips while sitting on the couch, after a while, seeing the couch will automatically prompt you to reach for the Doritos. These associations are sometimes so strong that you have to replace the couch with a wooden chair for the diet to succeed. It's kind of demoralizing to realize that that's actually true. You know, many of us lead exemplary lives, I'm sure, but we all have habits. Often there are eating habits, but there's just a whole gamut of things that we habitually do that aren't good for us, that we wouldn't choose to do, but we've been conditioned. We may have conditioned ourselves to do these things, and now it's hard not to do them. It's actually painful. It's painful. When an urge comes to grab that cookie, it can actually be, it's unpleasant not to give in. And so we've got a tall order of business if we want to lead the lives that we want to lead. What they did in Ghana, after all sorts of failures, is they finally got smart and they ran these campaigns that showed people coming out of bathrooms with some sort of purple ooze coming off their hands. What they decided to do was, rather than talk about bacteria or promoting health, they would simply associate going to the bathroom with feelings of disgust. And evidently, we think, well, of course, you know, you go to the bathroom, that's disgusting, you know, and we naturally wash our hands, or people tend to as they come out of the bathroom. But in third world countries where the predecessor of the toilet was a pit that people used, the toilet doesn't have those negative associations. And so they ran this campaign. They didn't talk. They only had about 4 seconds of this commercial showed people actually washing their hands with soap. But when they came back and studied behaviors, they found that there had been a marked increase in the number of people washing their hands after using the urinal, and an even bigger increase before eating a meal. It's kind of a funny thing, you know, you realize that they're manipulating people sort of for their own good. You can sort of think it's maybe ethically a little bit dubious, but on the other hand, when you realize that so many children are dying of diseases that could be so easily prevented, you have to say, yeah, I would do the same thing. You know, this business about these cues that trigger behavior, if you look around, you'll find that's really true. But the way that they work is through our being asleep. At least that's a large part of their power. For instance, you can't always replace the couch with a wooden chair when you're trying to give up the Doritos. Sometimes the couch has to stay there, but it helps if you realize, when I sit down on that couch, I'm going to get this urge. I've gotten it before. And you have sort of a fighting chance if you bring awareness to what's going on. I had one, I knew a person who was recovering from cocaine, and his one of his big triggers was, he was a contractor, and one of his big triggers was getting into his truck, because he was a snow plower and he would use cocaine when he was plowing all night, and so the two were just intimately entwined, and it was a struggle that in the end I don't think he won, or at least not while I knew him, to not use when he got into his truck. I've developed a habit of having a snack when I come home after sittings. I get home, I walk in the house, and that's a trigger. You know, it's hard to resist. One thing that you can do is you can associate that trigger with your desire to quit. That can be your reminder. Yeah, that's what I'm doing here. I'm no longer having that bowl of ice cream, or no longer sitting down to idly surf the net, or any of the other ways that you let attention and presence leak out of your life. One real good place to sort of work on these things is these term intensives that we do twice a year here at the center. There's one that's going to come up after the October Sesshin. It's really, after doing them for some time now, I really find it's a great opportunity to take a look, sort of make an inventory of what's going on in your life, and think about, you know, obviously I can't change everything. I'm not going to become perfect overnight. As they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, we're looking for progress, not perfection. But just to take a look and say, what could I maybe change here? And then get to know that. See what sort of resistances come up, and how it feels when you don't do it and when you do it. And sometimes those changes that are made in a term intensive can carry on and actually establish new behaviors. And sometimes not. Sometimes we're still struggling to establish an exercise program or learn a new chant. And the answer is just to keep at it and to increase our awareness. And to be aware that we aren't rational creatures. So much of what we do, as they said, you know, when they said 45% of what we do is triggered by habit, that's not hard to believe. There's a book that Scott lent me called Predictable Irrationality by a guy named Dan Ariely, which is another just fascinating book. And it's full of, this guy is an economist, and he's done lots and lots of studies about consumer behavior. It's just, there's just so many, I can't go into all of them, but let me cherry pick just a few. I want to talk about something called the Starbucks effect. I don't know how many people have gone into a Starbucks, and I don't know how many people have been hooked on it, but there are a lot of people who, after many, many years of, say, going to Dunkin' Donuts and drinking an adequate and cheap cup of coffee, have found themselves going to Starbucks and spending maybe $4 a cup for something that perhaps is marginally better, but might not be what you would choose if you stopped and thought about it logically. What he's found is that for all sorts of decisions that we make, like how much to spend on something or anything that's complicated, basically we don't want to think it through. It's just too hard to think about all the variables, and so we find shortcuts. Maybe it's the first amount we ever paid for something, then we don't really want to pay a whole lot more than that. Or well, here's an example. If you're going out to buy a house and the realtor shows you three houses, let's say a ranch house and a colonial and then another colonial with a bad roof. Studies have shown that most people will pick the colonial with the good roof. If it was just the ranch house and the colonial, maybe it would be split 50-50. But when there's something to compare one choice with and make that choice seem superior to its alternative, we inevitably go to that that thing that we can easily compare. We want an easy sort of way of making a decision. And so without knowing it, we gravitate to things and we don't even really know why. And then once we've selected something, for instance, once you've gone into Starbucks and you've bought that first cup of coffee, now you're sort of imprinted on it. You're a person who drinks Starbucks coffee, and so it's much easier to go in the second time. And then the third time, it's sort of like, he says, it's sort of like, you know, you walk by a restaurant and you see a line there and you think, oh, this must be a good restaurant. So you get in line and you go in, and now you're sort of, you know, this is your restaurant and you discovered it and you're going to tend to go back. The same thing happens. You create your own line. By doing something over and over again, you learn or decide on a subconscious level, this is the sort of thing that I do. I'm a Starbucks person. I go to Starbucks. And so you're much likely to repeat behavior, which is why bad habits start so easily and then are so hard to eradicate. He says, recall your first introduction to Starbucks perhaps several years ago. And I apologize to people who've never been into a Starbucks and congratulate them as well. I assume that nearly everyone has had this experience since Starbucks sits on every corner in America. The center has an investment advisor, and we had him here on Friday, and in the course of conversation, he was mentioning how Starbucks stock has dropped dramatically because they're closing 600 stores, and we all observed that that's barely a drop in the bucket, and we mentally counted. There are six Starbucks along Monroe Avenue as you start in Oxford Street and head out to Pittsburgh. There are six different Starbucks along that one street alone. Starbucks closed 600, so 1% of that number is on Monroe Avenue. Those didn't get closed, of course. Anyway, you're sleepy and in desperate need of a liquid energy boost as you embark on an errand one afternoon. You glance through the windows at Starbucks and walk in. The prices of the coffee are a shock. You've been blissfully drinking the brew at Dunkin' Donuts for years, but since you've walked in and are now curious about what coffee at this price might taste like, you surprise yourself. Buy a small coffee, enjoy its taste and its effect on you, and walk out. The following week, you walk by Starbucks again. Should you go in? The ideal decision-making process should take into account the quality of the coffee, Starbucks versus Dunkin' Donuts, the prices at the two places, and of course, the cost or value of walking a few more blocks to get to Dunkin' Donuts. This is a complex computation. So instead, you resort to the simple approach. I went to Starbucks before, and I enjoyed myself and the coffee, so this must be a good decision for me. So you walk in and get another small cup. In doing so, you just became the second person in line standing behind yourself. A few days later, you again walk by Starbucks, and this time you vividly remember your past decisions, act on them again, voila! You become the third person in line standing behind yourself. As the weeks pass, you enter again and again, and every time you feel more strongly that you are acting on the basis of your preferences. Buying a coffee at Starbucks has become a habit with you. He says then, there's something odd in this story. If anchoring, that's this process of you do something and now it's what you do, is based on our initial decisions, how did Starbucks manage to become an initial decision in the first place? In other words, if we were previously anchored to the prices at Dunkin' Donuts, how did we move our anchor to Starbucks? This is where it really gets interesting. The guy, his name is Howard Schultz, created Starbucks. He was an intuitive businessman. He worked diligently to separate Starbucks from other coffee shops, not through price, but through ambiance. Accordingly, he designed Starbucks from the very beginning to feel like a continental coffee house. The early shops were fragrant with the smell of roasted beans, and better quality roasted beans than those at Dunkin' Donuts. They sold fancy French coffee presses. The showcases presented alluring snacks. Where Dunkin' Donuts had small, medium, and large coffees, Starbucks offered a short, tall, grande, and venti, as well as drinks with high pedigree names like Cafe Americano, Cafe Misto, Macchiato, and Frappuccino. Starbucks did everything in its power, in other words, to make the experience feel different, so different that we would not use the prices at Dunkin' Donuts as an anchor, but instead would be open to the new anchor that Starbucks was preparing for us. And that, to a great extent, is how Starbucks succeeded. But the bottom line in all of this is how easily we're manipulated and the power of that first decision. It's looking at it from a positive point of view. I went to the dentist many years ago, and I have terrible teeth. Or let's say I have extremely powerful bacteria that live in my mouth, and I really have to be diligent in order to not have cavities run amok. And my dentist said, you're going to have to start flossing your teeth every night, and you're going to have to use this special high fluoride gel on your teeth right before you go to bed. And if you do that, you should be able to keep things in check and do much, much better. And I just couldn't get that habit started for a long, long time. And finally, what actually got me over the hump was my next checkup, when I went in and I had cavities and root canals, and it cost a lot of money. And then I started doing it, and it's now something I always do. I would say maybe I miss one time every couple years has been my average. Dead tired, you know, at 1 o'clock at night, if I've been up for some reason, I still find I have to go in and do that routine, because all I can think about is what's going to happen inside my mouth if I don't. The idea of going to bed without having done that is aversive, and so it's an ingrained habit, which is a good one. Roshi Kaplow used to compare sitting zazen to brushing your teeth. We're really sitting down and scrubbing our mind. There's nothing quite so effective at clearing away just the habitual thoughts that are running through our heads when we're busy or harassed than sitting in zazen. And it's extremely important to establish that pattern of sitting every day. But it's very hard for people. I'm always scratching my head at people who come to the center, they go to a workshop, they join, they're quite enthusiastic. It is their intention to establish a viable practice, and most people don't succeed for whatever reasons. You know, maybe they decide this just isn't for me, but I suspect with a lot of people, it just, there's too many other things to do. You have to make some level of commitment to make that change, and you have to value it for that to happen. You can see the same pattern with people trying to overcome addictions, alcohol or drugs or overeating. There has to be a moment when you see how sick you are, when you see how much you need to do things differently. the first step in AA is we realize that our lives, let's see, Katie, help me out here. We recognize we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. And then the second step is came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So the first thing I take out of that is that we're recognizing that we're quite literally insane when we do negative behaviors over and over again and suffer the consequences. And the other genius in that approach is this business about a power greater than ourselves. Now, for a lot of people, that means a guy in the sky, but not necessarily so. What it means is there are changes that we can't make through our deciding mind. I always think of George Bush. He's the decider. You might want to deploy your deciding mind to decide whether to go to the store or not, but your deciding mind isn't so great at giving up an addiction. And so you need to find something else, something that's bigger than the ego self. And that can actually be just awareness. It can be Zen practice. It can be attention. Our problems with habits are not just the outward things that we do. The real big problem is the way we think. It's the way we use our minds on a daily basis. Anyone who's practiced for any length of time becomes acutely aware of how their mind goes astray. But that doesn't mean that everybody is able to overcome it, certainly not overcome it completely. There's so many people who, after years and years of practice, are still complaining, I feel I'm no good at this, I feel inadequate, I'm overwhelmed by negative thoughts, what's wrong with me? And even if we point out that that's just another thought, there's no need to fight that thought, just drop it, just return to the practice. People still get caught up in those thoughts. They're another habit. And thinking those thoughts seems to us to be who we are. Who would I be without those thoughts? If I wasn't criticizing myself, wouldn't other people step in and point my faults out to me? There's a tendency especially when you're sitting, and this can come up in sesshin. You know you're off. You know you're clinging to certain negative thoughts. You're not really totally into the practice, but you can't quite work your way out of it. You're sort of struggling with it. And the problem is you're not bringing awareness to the task. Instead, you're bringing your preference and your desire. What we do naively in practice is we try to move from a bad state of mind to a good state of mind. We try to be the agent that moves us from one state to another. But this is actually profoundly unskillful, and it's not our job. One of the reasons why practice is so simple and so direct, just the breath, just mu, is that we need to be taken off that task of trying to manipulate ourselves, trying to decide I like this and I don't like that. These negative things that come into the mind, they're not good and they're not bad. The problem is they're triggers for us to get involved in this fruitless struggle, to get caught up with them, to argue with them. Actually get much better results if you can meet these things with a little bit of humor and with curiosity. Okay, here I am thinking these same thoughts again. It's interesting. How do they make me feel? What's happening in my body? Am I tightening up in my chest? Am I getting angry? Do I feel the blood rising to my head? Just to sort of shine a little light in the corner instead of immediately going to, this isn't what I want. This isn't what I'm supposed to be doing. I hope Roshi isn't aware of how I'm thinking and using my mind. Oh my God, got to get into this new state of mind. If instead we can realize that however we are right now is reality and it cannot be changed. You cannot not be thinking what you're thinking. Nevertheless, it won't stay the same. It will never stay the same. You're not going to continue having these particular thoughts for the rest of your life. They're going to move on. In fact, the only way you can keep them around is to fight with them, to indulge them, basically, to traffic with them, to believe them. It's the biggest mistake, is to believe thoughts. We don't decide what we think. Thoughts just come unbidden into the mind. The only decision we make is whether to stick with them or not. And that's the decision that makes them come back. But so many people feel, I'm thinking this, so this must be what I think. Well, literally, yeah, you're thinking it, but it's not you. Just because you have this feeling that you're worthless doesn't mean that you're worthless or you're a person who always has to think this. There's Roshi read a while back in Taisho from this woman, Byron Katie. She's sort of this phenomenon that sprung into the national consciousness, at least of people who are pursuing various spiritual matters. She was lived in California, and she had some sort of awakening experience and has sort of developed a practice that she teaches other people to do, which she calls the work. And there is some genius to a lot of what she says and a lot of her method, which is this radical acceptance of things as they are. You might argue that in some cases she goes too far with that. I really don't know what I think about, you know, some of the things that she says. She's ready to accept anything, absolutely anything. But it sure does apply to the stuff going through our heads. It's if we can just for a moment not flinch from it, the first thing that happens when we feel stress is to want to get out of it. If we can realize, and here's how she puts it. She says, it's easy to be swept up by some overwhelming feeling. So it's helpful to remember that any stressful feeling is like a compassionate alarm clock that says, you're caught in the dream. If we can, if we begin to have faith in this moment, however it is, good, bad, we're doing well, we're looking bad, if we can just have faith, this is as it is, and meet it completely. Say yes completely. Then things change. We always want to put English on it. You know, it's like when you, you're bowling and you roll the ball and it's headed for the gutter. You always want to twist your body and try to get it to turn to the pins. And we do the same thing with our minds. We're always trying to whip them into shape. But we can let go to a little bit. We can be a little more gentle, have a little more awareness, compassion for ourselves, humor, and let the process work. Practice is a process. We don't come in with an agenda. We do, it's not real practice. We're not trying to be someone that we're not. We're trying to be who we are. We're not trying to get something outside of us. We're trying to wake up to what we've always been and we've always had. It's hard to have faith in that because we have these patterns in us that go back so far, you know, to when we were children. We learned that our job is to please other people. We learned to see ourselves through the eyes of others. It's that great book that Richard Feynman wrote entitled, What Do You Care What Other People Think? And when you look at it, why should I care what someone else thinks about me? What does that have to do with me? Nothing. And yet we care so much. Just to let go of that a little bit is a huge, huge liberation. Just to be able to have a bad mood sweep over us and not have feel like the world is coming to an end or our worth as a person is being brought into question. Just as sometimes the weather is good, sometimes the weather is bad. It's all weather. And the engine to be able to do this is Zazen. We have to sit. We have to put a value on bringing attention into our life. And we have to be skillful enough to create the habits of attention. I had a friend who tried to train himself. Every time he walked through a doorway, he would think of Mu. I'm not sure how well it worked, but I thought it's a good idea. You know, we keep forgetting. It's amazing how long we can be just following thoughts, just wool gathering, one thought after another, until we suddenly, wait a minute. And we come back to the practice, the breath or the koan. Anything we can do to come back more often, and anything we can do to increase our willingness to come back when we notice, is going to have a huge positive effect. Not an effect that we direct or manipulate, or that we know how it's going to work out, or you know, whether we're going to come to awakening, or have some other wonderful thing happen to us. That's totally out of our hands. All we're really able to do is to do the work, to bring that openness and that acceptance to this moment right now. It's worth doing. And it's so daunting how easy it is not to get it done. It's so sobering to see so many people who say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to come to Sesshin. 3 years later, still haven't seen them. I'm going to come and practice. It's not that they decided not to do it. Life just swept them away. It's like practice is like you're in a fast-flowing stream, and you've got your hand on a branch, and you're hanging on. And then you realize, okay, there's something I need to do with both hands, and you let go for a moment. You're down the stream. When will you grab another branch? You know, maybe quickly, maybe not for a long, long time. And life is short. If it's something that you know you want to do, then you can't just go on automatic pilot and say, okay, I'll sit every now and then, you know, I come to the center, hopefully someday, you know, it'll work for me. Need to be a little more creative. You know, what can I do to bring awareness more into my life? What habits do I have that are negative for me? What people do I hang out with that maybe I could, would be, you know, the Buddha, this is one of the big things the Buddha stressed over and over again, was the company of the wise. It makes such a difference who we spend our time with. If somebody gets sober and then they hang out in bars, their chances are pretty slim that they're going to stay sober. If they hang out with other sober people, chances go up. It's the same thing with practice. If you spend time with people who value what you're doing, then it helps. It helps on a subconscious level, a way you don't even understand. It's why it's so great to come into the Zendo and sit with other people. It's so much easier. There's so many cues here that we don't even know about that help us turn in and do real Zazen. Well, I feel I'm turning this into a lecture. So I think I'll stop here, and does anybody have any comments or questions? Or yeah, Katie.
First, thank you. Thank you for bringing this topic up. I just wanted to make a comment, which was that in my own Zen practice, I couldn't on my own bear placing attention on the wreckage and the dumpster brain that I had. And it was only after I had been in 12-step program for a long time before I found the warmth and the support there that I didn't find silently in the Zendo. It was kind of like solitary confinement, my first machine. It was kind of a hell room. And it was only through the 12-step program where I felt the warmth and the strength and the reminders that this is a big delusional system. You know, that was what made it possible. It was a combination of the two things. So the Sangha part was essential, not just the attention, because I couldn't get attention until I had a Sangha that was helping me break.
Yeah. It's you know, everybody has to find their own way, and there isn't any one way. You know, my early days at the center, I was trying to be a certain kind of person. You know, we had a model of this is what a good Zen student is, and it caused immense grief because I really wasn't that person. You know, and I had a similar, you know, even before doing 12-step, I realized I just have to be who I am, and you know, that's going to have to be good enough. Yeah, Christopher.
What I find so fascinating about trying to break habits is hearing other people's stories, how incredibly creative they get in breaking their habits. And Taishin just did a wedding yesterday, and so we met some people outside of the Sangha, and there's this one woman, her name was Mouse. Change her name to Mouse. And she lives in LA, and she'd been smoking for 19 and a half years, and then finally she made a decision she was going to quit. And so this is what she did. She said she prepared for a month. She knew at the end of this month she was going to quit smoking. So she was smoking every day, and she was just kind of saying, okay, this was like day 26, day 25, day 24, still smoking. And then on the last day, she lives on the coast somewhere, so she went down to the beach and she just chain smoked one cigarette after another. And I think she made it to 26 cigarettes, and she passed out. And she had someone there with her. And when she woke up, she said, "Patient, you remember what was called like the Monica Stairs or the Santa Barbara Stairs? It's these huge stairs. You just go up. It's endless." And she just crawled her way up to the top, and then that was it. And then, but she also changed her habits. Like she stopped talking on the phone because that was a trigger, you know. Mm-hmm. And she stopped hanging around with people who smoking. She pretty much became like this corner of her, this recluse for quite a while until finally she quit smoking completely. And she hasn't. It's been like I think in 3 or 4 years. But I just couldn't believe that she just chain smoked on the beach, you know, passed out. Something that worked for her.
Yeah, Deborah.
I'll try to get a copy of this because it was really interesting. But I recently read, it's like a copy. the most important thing. You know, every talk of his is the most important thing. But in this one, the most important thing was the struggle between impulse and will. And impulse happens so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like eating the cookie, it happens so fast. You know, and where does will come from?
Yeah.
I'm asking.
Yeah, no, it's not a thought.
But,
you know, I said you've only got so much will, and if you try to do too much at one time, you're going to, you're sort of primed for failure.
Yeah.
But the other side of it is you can increase the amount of willpower you have. It's like a muscle. You know, when you use it, it gets stronger. So it's not like never use your willpower. Use it, you know, use it creatively and use it, you know, it's best to attack countries that you know you can subdue.
Sometimes, like, one is trying to constantly harness what you might call lower impulses, you know, to
but the other
aggressive impulses or
the other thing,
indulgent impulses, you know.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, though, is to see clearly, you know, to see those impulses for what they are, to just to be more intimate with them without giving into them. That awareness, you know, with people who need to quit, you know, drugs, alcohol, they need to see. There has to be that moment of clarity when suddenly, you know, I hear from Sony, if suddenly I realize what I was doing to myself. I know Anthony DeMello has one example of a guy who was actually a Jesuit priest who was a drunk, and he said, you know, I love my family. I knew I was killing them, but I just couldn't stop until one day I just saw. I just woke up and I saw, and then it was easy. It fell away. So sometimes, you know, rather than just through willpower, because I should, because I should, because I should, there can be something that comes, and I can't tell you where that comes from either, that's just an awareness.
Do you think you can get to a point where you have a sense of mastery in your life and these things are simply no longer issues? Or is that a fantasy place?
Progress, not perfection.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the areas of mastery that people have expand dramatically, you know, when they work on themselves. But almost all of us fall short of full awakening, so... In fact, everybody I know.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that, especially with practice, that comes on in this is the attentiveness that starts to occur. And the idea of what you said earlier is that, you know, I've lost your thoughts. Thoughts aren't real. Somewhere in my habits. You know, and I think it's something that
Britta.
I lose color as I study art, and in order to do so, you have to step back every time. Step back. And then I discovered as I was here, at the center, that it's the same as life, that you are the one who can create your life, so you have to step back. When you see something that's it's so tight, then simply have some flexibility and go up there and look at you like a picture and, okay, what I like to change, and throw something at it or gently touch it and...
Yeah.
And step back again. This can be a picture too. That reminds me, there was an advertisement in Germany. You see somebody in the room and is doing something, and then this person is grabbing, like as a picture, and is crunching it like paper, and then a new picture was there. And this person is doing the same or something else, and it's grabbing again. New one. And it was fascinating. I was staring at it. That's it.
Okay, well, we're at our stopping point, so why don't we chant the four vows?